This episode is brought to you by Chiefs on Broadway. There's a different way to experience live music in Nashville. Eric Church's Chiefs on Broadway is home to the Neon Steeple, an intimate live music venue in the heart of downtown Nashville, where artists and songwriters take the stage for up-close, unforgettable shows. From stripped-down sets to surprise guests, no two nights are the same. Check out the Neon Steeple lineup and get your tickets now at chiefsonbroadway.com.
Hello, my name is Olivia Harding, and I am the host of Folk Files, a podcast that explores the tangled history of folk songs. Every month, I choose a topic to dive into for about 20 to 30 minutes. The subject of each episode could be a song. In the case of Shady Grove, a lot of people believe that it is a later version of the English folk song Matty Groves, but it's not that simple. A general topic. The main theme that I saw while researching folk songs about birds from all over the world is that many of them include nonsense syllables meant to represent the bird songs. Or a question that I want to answer. There has never been any real question that Black people were central to the development of this musical style. So why do we still picture white men hauling on the rope when we think of sea shanties? Press play and join me on a journey through the origins of murder ballads, sea shanties, rebel songs, and other music that has withstood the test of time. Folk Files is so pleased to be the newest show to join the BGS Podcast Network. Find us at thebluegrasssituation.com or where you listen.
Hi, and welcome to Basic Folk, where we have honest conversations with folk musicians on the bluegrass situation. It's your host, Cindy House. Thanks for listening today. We have Alila Diane on the show today. Very excited about her new album and return to form on this record. Get to that in just a moment. There are a few different ways that we can stay in touch as Basic Folk friends and family. You can sign up for our newsletter at the link in the show notes, or you can go to basicfolk.com and sign up for the newsletter there. You can also follow us on social media at Basic Folk Pod on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok and YouTube. You can also support us with a donation. That link is in the show notes as well, or you can go to basicfolk.com. Okay, let's do it. Back in the mid-2000s, Alila Diane's gospel pirate album was ringing my bell, and apparently it was ringing a lot of other people's bells too, especially Europeans. Alila's debut album went gold in France, and she's been able to maintain a pretty decent audience and career across the Atlantic. Meanwhile, at home in the States, she's based in Portland, Oregon. After 2013, she remained relatively unknown and undiscovered, and that was just fine with her. She worked on her music, occasionally flew over to Europe to tour, played local gigs, and raised her two daughters with her husband in their 1892 Victorian mansion. While they were renovating their crazy old house, they also got their daughters a landline and a CD player each, along with their old CD collections. Everything was pretty chill and great. Then her friend and mentor, Michael Hurley, the godfather of freak folk, died last year at the age of 83. After paying a tribute show to Michael, she started connecting with her Portland music community. She would go to shows, inviting people like Anna Tivel over, starting to collaborate with others in town. This all led to her new album, Who's Keeping Time? This time around, she's really going full stop on a huge tour where she's going to be gone roughly 40% of the year from May through December. It feels like a huge return for the singer-songwriter who is feeling inspired by creating, collaborating, and being in community again. Let's take a listen to a song from Alila's new album. This is Dusty Roses, and then we'll get to our conversation with Alila Diane on Basic Folk.
Straight hair, some dark secret held dusty roses strung up on the wall. Dusty roses, where has our girl gone? Ooh, ooh, ooh.
Alila Diane, welcome to Basic Folk. It's so nice to see you.
Thank you for having me.
So I want to first of all start by talking about your wonderful style that you have. You are always looking so fly. You have like a vintage, like the style, it's like vintage and crisp and neat, but like not too neat. Always like great coloring, attention to detail. Like to me, your style inspires like a certain type of slowness and peace and quiet that like I always want and I never have. So how do you feel about your style and where it might intersect with your musicality? And like when I say style, I mean like clothing, album artwork, your house, like your album covers, et cetera, and so on.
So I think my music is so deeply intertwined with just who I am. And part of who I am is I'm a very visual person. And my home and what I wear and everything is so connected to my being and my creative aesthetic as well, that it's all just one and the same, which I think is why my music inherently feels connected to that style too.
How did you develop your fashion style? My wife and I like own a house and like styled it together, but it was like very difficult to get there. But I'm just wondering like what your fashion journey was like.
I think it's always just, it's been an ever evolving path, and it's something that I enjoy. I mean, my house, we live in this bizarre, wild, crazy old Victorian in Portland, and the house kind of was the perfect example of like, this is my aesthetic. Like I need to live in this, in this house. And when I was a kid, I had a Victorian dollhouse. And, you know, when we met 20 years ago, I was very into vintage fashion and I still am, but I think I was more like, my outfit cost $5 because I got everything at the thrift store, you know, 20 years ago. Yeah. I really prided myself on that hunting and gathering and collecting treasures everywhere that I went. And then as I've gotten older, there are other pieces that have come into the fold. I think I kind of rejected vintage for about 10 years when I was really in the deepest part of parenthood. It wasn't suiting me as much, but just in the past couple of years, I've like really gotten back into it. And it's a lot of, it's fun because now I'm incorporating some stuff, pieces that I've had for 20 years. And I'm like, oh, this cool denim vest, I'm going to start wearing this again. That's something that I used to wear when I was, you know, 25. And it's been fun to reincorporate stuff that I've been holding on to. And I'm also always just collecting little bits, like wherever I travel. So that's a big part of that aesthetic through line as well. I'm a little bit of a hoarder low key.
I'm so impressed that you have all these things still. Like, I feel like I've just like gotten rid of so much stuff.
I've gotten rid of things too. I have let go of a lot, but I think because there's this constant collecting, it's an ebb and a flow. And I have gotten rid of some things where I'm like, I shouldn't have let that go, you know?
Yeah.
Our house is pretty, it's a pretty big old house. So I think I finally live in a place where things that I had been hoarding in my basement for years actually have found a home here. They have a spot to be. So it doesn't feel crowded or overwhelming here because everything like has its little place.
Okay. What's the square footage? What are we talking about here?
It's like 5,000 square feet, including the basement though. So,
okay. Is it finished in the basement?
The basement's not finished. So that's probably 1,200 square feet you could take away from the house, but it's three stories. And where I'm sitting right now is my attic studio, which is probably about 1,000 to 1,200 square feet up just up here on the third floor.
That's amazing.
It's kind of wild.
Yeah.
It's terrible if you lose your phone in here, though. It's all over. You're hiking up and down stairwells.
So you grew up in the Gold Rush town of Nevada City, California. Also, for those keeping track at home, the hometown of Joanna Newsom.
Correct.
And of the town, you have mentioned its winding rivers, and you've also said, no matter how much time passes, part of my heart will always live among those golden hills. So how has the landscape of your hometown impacted you throughout your life?
I think it's something I'm always reflecting back on. It's such an incredibly beautiful place. And having spent my whole childhood there and just absorbing the nature and going to the river and the sunshine, the California sunshine, the flowers blooming, I always will carry that with me. And now in the Northwest, I live in Portland and I've been here for 20 years now. It's much greener up here and it's a different landscape, but it's still beautiful and the seasons change. And every spring, the Portland springtimes are just astounding. Everything really comes to life and is in bloom. And I think for me, it's the passage of seasons that feels really crucial for the mm-hmm. marking of time. And mm-hmm. it's wild that I never went back to California, yet my life kind of just got established here. I have a family and I'm raising kids in Portland. My husband's from Washington. He didn't want to move to Nevada City, you know? And we've created a life here that touches on those things that I did have in Nevada City. We have a half acre. We've got a big yard. My kids are running around free in our yard. Our little dog has space to roam. And it's beautiful here, too, you know?
Hmm. Yeah. You grew up with parents who were artists and musicians. So how did their example influence how you have come to feel about art and music, whether you're creating it or you're experiencing it?
I think having creative parents, my mom is a painter and a singer, and my dad is a great musician, as they were both in a lot of like bluegrass bands and folk projects when I was growing up. My dad's been in a Grateful Dead cover band since I was like 12. And I think music and art were always such an inherent part of my life when I was a kid that I think it was quite normalized. And so it felt very natural for me to then start pursuing a creative career.
Hmm. I dug through your Substack.
I love it.
Yeah, I also loved it. You had a post a while back that mentioned that you were making music with your dad again. I think this was like last
mm-hmm.
year.
Mm-hmm.
He has been like a big part of your musical journey, working with you on some of your albums, even like playing guitar with you and your band.
Mm-hmm.
I heard he quit his day job.
A while back, yeah. Yeah.
So what has music done for your relationship with your father?
I think music has been a place that my dad and I can drop into and connect on. And that has been a very beautiful thing to have with my dad, because there aren't a lot of other places where we can easily like drop in. But music has always been that. It's always the excuse to have a visit. The next time I'm going to see my dad, he's coming up to play with me for Pickathon in Portland. And, you know, he's excited to play the gig. And he's also excited to see me. But to encourage him to come up, it was like, oh, well, I'll come up for Pickathon. So that's kind of just how it is with my dad. And the most recent project I did with him has not been released yet, but he and I recorded really stripped back duo versions of a handful of my old songs and a handful of my new songs and some cover songs. And it's the kind of project that it was just special to make with my dad. We just sat there across from each other and recorded it in 2 days. And I don't think it's the kind of record that will have a big like press push, or it's not going to be like, this is the next album. It's more a special thing that we made together that I think my deep fans will really appreciate. And so at some point, probably in the next year or so, I will strategically, you know, press it on vinyl and do a small little release around it, or maybe release a digital version that's just an EP and then have the full length be on a 12-inch vinyl or something like that without branding it as my next full length. That makes sense. It's more of like a side project.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah.
So your musical career kind of got started around 2004. You self-released your debut album, The Pirate's Gospel, and you worked on it with your dad. And on your Substack, you said it's an album which more people listen to than anything else that I've released since then. It's strange to be known for who you were rather than who you've become, which is intense.
Yeah, totally.
How do you reckon with that statement and that album?
Well, it has been interesting. So my career has been weird because in America, I'm not very known. Like I have never had a certain amount of success or whatever in this country. That just has never happened for me. But in Europe, I developed a really strong following, and I can go over there, and I've continued touring in Europe for the last 20 years because that first record was quite successful there. It went gold in France. It's still my most highly streamed music. The Pirate's Gospel, the lead single off that record, I think gets like close to 500,000 plays a month.
A month?
Yeah, which is crazy.
Wow.
So people over there are still listening to that. And these are recordings that I made when I was 21 years old.
A golden oldie.
Yes.
Yeah.
With my dad, we did not know anyone would hear that record. And so over in Europe, when I tour over there, I have to play a lot of old songs because I'm essentially riding my own coattails still of that kind of original, you know, flash in the pan success that I had over there. And it's been interesting, like that's been the case. And my hope for this new record is, I mean, who knows, but like, this is the first release that I've had on a US record label since I was dropped from Rough Trade in 2012. Mm. I haven't had any US support since then. And we'll see, but I'm hoping that I'm able to get back out there in my own country and actually play shows that people show up to.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Wow. Okay. Yeah. I'm also excited to see what happens.
Me too. Very curious.
So right around the time that The Pirate's Gospel came out back in 2003, 2004, your family of origin, your parents and your brother were all going through their own hard times. And if people want to read more about it, again, I will refer them to Alila Diane's Substack. It's a really great post called Reoccurring Dreams, Songs and Trespassing in My Childhood Home, which like, hopefully that's an intriguing title because it's
yes.
a really cool post. So back to your family, like you sum it up by sharing, it wasn't a great chapter for any of us, and talk about basically like that's right around the time where your childhood ended.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
How do you look back on those times of like letting go of your family through the lens of being a parent yourself? Like, and what does it make you hope for your daughters when they are on that journey towards adulthood, when their childhood is dying?
Yeah, that was a really hard moment for me. My parents divorced at that moment as well, and they sold the home that I grew up in. And that was right around when I was 20 years old. And everything that I had known in that, the stability of that childhood, you know, all of a sudden I was an adult and I was in San Francisco living on my own. And it was really hard. But that's the thing that that was the catalyst for writing songs. That's why I started writing songs, is because I had this heaviness that I needed to process. And I don't know that I would have become a songwriter if that hadn't have happened. And now I think that that pain has eased, largely because I have my own home. I have my own family now. My daughters are 12 and 9 years old, and I'm getting to live that childhood alongside them, with them, as the parent now. And my hope and my intention is to not have everything blow up for them when they come into early adulthood, and that hopefully we will still have this home that they can come back to and always be welcome at, in a way that I didn't really have at that age.
Mm. So you started your family 2013, you got married, you had your mm-hmm. first daughter, Vera, excellent mm-hmm. name.
Thank you.
And you mentioned this while you were pregnant, you were dropped by your label, and mm-hmm. then you were also passed on another because you were going to have a baby. And you said you learned that it's hard to trust a system that values youth and trends, and that the antidote is to keep showing up and keep doing it anyway, keep putting out mm-hmm. music anyways. Mm-hmm. So before we started our chat, we had a little bit of a discussion about so this is like inside baseball over here.
Yeah.
I was reading Alila's press release, and it said something about how like you were over a decade into your career. And I was mm-hmm. like, wait a second, isn't it 2 decades? Mm-hmm. And you were like, we debated it and it made me sound old. So I decided to mm-hmm. put a decade in. I hope it's okay. I bring
yes.
that up.
No,
for
it's
this.
Great. I'm happy to talk about it. I love this sort of thing.
So like, what was your relationship to youth and like those fleeting trends prior to like getting dropped by your label? Mm-hmm. And then like how was that relationship to youth, fleeting trends, like trying to get the clicks and the, I guess mm-hmm. like you weren't getting mm-hmm. streams back in 2013,
right.
but like how has that changed? Was that changed by that experience?
Well, I think the music industry is very typically and historically youth obsessed. And what I learned pretty early on after the release of my third record, which was a record called Wild Divine, and then I was dropped by Rough Trade and not given the opportunity, I had fallen pregnant, like things had changed. But at that point, it felt like, oh, you're done. You're done, lady. You've been given your chance, and you had 3 records, and we don't need you anymore. You're replaceable. There's another girl with an acoustic guitar that we will put on our roster instead. Any festival opportunities, there's always another folky girl with a guitar that they can put on the festival next year, and it's not going to be you again. And that was really hard. There have been peaks and there have been deep, dark valleys in this career. And for the past 12 years, while I've been raising kids, I've essentially gotten no opportunities or very limited opportunities and limited press and anything in my own country for the fact I've been quietly releasing records in the States. But they kind of are like, oh, well, you're old. You had a shot. It didn't work. You never reached that milestone.
Mm-hmm.
I think especially labels, like larger, cool, hip indie labels, it's like they give you a couple shots. And if it doesn't become the next big successful thing, they're very unlikely to continue rooting for you. And
jeez.
That is, it's, yeah, it feels really like, not great. And I know so many artists who, especially women, who have experienced just that. And it's, yeah, it's pretty messed up.
Yeah. And it also is like, I don't know if you were like feeling that before, mm-hmm. before this experience was happening, but like, it just goes to show like how important it is to like work with people who are like real, who like,
right.
Who,
yes.
who see the value in investing in an artist that is going to be solid and sturdy.
long term.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because they're, I mean,
those places do exist, but they're fewer and farther between, for sure.
Yeah, for yeah, sure. Definitely. I'm sure we could have a coffee
deep,
and name deep
dive
all of
on
them.
That.
Yes, yeah, for sure,
exactly. But it does. It's interesting now, kind of giving it another shot and having signed with one of those more long game boutique, small, very invested record labels called Fluff and Gravy in the US. And it feels really positive to be working with John, who's the one guy at Fluff and Gravy.
Yeah.
And his whole heart is dedicated to this. And, you know, I honestly feel younger now and more energetic and with it at 43 than I did 10 years ago, you know, when I had a newborn baby and a 3-year-old.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, it feels
that,
good
that,
to be
that makes sense, yeah.
coming back into myself.
So your two daughters, Vera and Una, you mentioned your house. It's an 1892 Victorian house. You have a landline.
We have a landline, too.
Your daughters have CD players in their rooms.
They do.
You said, we have created a life that is in some ways a strange combination of 1890 and 1990, which is so funny. So I have an 11-month-old daughter, and I am like so freaked about the way people like consume media and consume music through screens. So can
yes.
you, Alila, tell me step by step how you did this and like where are screens in your life and in your family's life?
So my girls are at Waldorf school, which is very limited on screens. They don't use screens at all at school. And you basically sign a contract that says your kid's not going to watch TV during the school week. Like weekends are different. So having that kind of parameter up from the school and having it not be our decision, but being able to say, sorry,
wow.
you can't watch school on weekdays or watch TV on school days because the school doesn't want you to. It's not my decision. Sorry, kid. They just get used to it and they know that that's off the table. And it has allowed us to just have more freedom in the physical realm and have the kids less whiny about the screens because it's just off the table. And then on the weekend, I mean, of course, Una's like, Mom, it's Friday. Can I watch TV? You know, and she can watch some TV on the weekend. And you know, the screens exist. My older daughter is 12 now. She does not have a phone yet. She has been whining about getting an Apple Watch because, you know, she has more independence now. There's a lot of times where she gets dropped off at soccer or she goes on a walk or she goes to a grocery store by herself. And she's like, I want to be able to call you if something, you know, if I feel scared or nervous or you don't show up when you say you're going to show up. And that's probably going to happen pretty soon, I think. But it feels a little better than a phone because she's not going to have endless internet access. She's not going to be surfing the web on an inch by inch little thing on her wrist, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It'll be more for like, it's more like a weird little walkie-talkie that you can call your parents on. But you can also like stream music on it. So the kids do have some playlists now they've been listening to as well. But the CD players were great. Like that is an awesome way to get kids into music and also like have it be a bit limited to what they have access to. They really have been enjoying the CD players and they're mostly listening to our old CDs from the early 2000s. So bless their
that's
hearts.
Awesome.
It's funny. You're like, oh, listening to Cat Power.
Yeah,
cool.
Totally. Yeah. That's another thing. I got rid of all my CDs. One day I just dropped them all off at the Goodwill.
You know.
And I regret
You can
it.
Always go back to the Goodwill and collect some new ones.
That's what I've been thinking about, yeah. So you have been mentioning that you have made records and toured Europe these last few years, but like have not really been doing anything or getting much coverage with those records in the U.S. But like this time for this record, it seems different. You said that your kids are older and you like felt a shift towards music. Mm-hmm. When did you feel that shift and was it easy to turn towards it?
I felt the shift about a year ago, maybe a little more than a year ago. I was writing these songs I recorded it last August. So the previous fall, I had started writing songs and I was going up to my studio every day during school hours to like work on writing. And I felt really isolated in it. And I was making demos and they were solo recordings. And I would play them back. And the guy that was helping me record them, his name's Ross, he was just like, yes, this is it. This is the record. Like, this is great. You solo, that's all you need. And I just, in my deepest heart of hearts, I was like, this isn't the record I want to make. I'm so sick of doing this alone. And I'm so sick of having to tour alone out of circumstance because it's too expensive to go with a band and da 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 and just be on my own island in this. And so the writing was happening. And then last spring, when Michael Hurley passed away, I was invited to perform one of his songs at his memorial. And what happened is I went and I saw all these faces from the Portland music community, people I hadn't seen in like a decade. Because I hadn't been going to shows and I hadn't been engaging with the music community here. And something in me sort of woke up and was like, oh, if I want to play music, you know, with people again, and if I want to be a part of something and if I want to re-engage, I have to start showing up. And so I just started going out to shows more than I've been to more shows in the past year than I had been in the previous decade. And wow, it's been incredible. There are all these people that I didn't know that are out there making great music. And I've met a lot of people. And that is how I met the players that I made the record with, is just by showing face and leaving my house. And Hurley's memorial was like that catalyst of like, I got to get out of the house.
I'm wondering, I love the role that Michael has played in this record and in this shift in you. I was wondering if you could talk about how you still feel his presence in your life, even though he's gone.
I mean, we have listened to he's a part of our life simply because we're playing his records often. We have a record player in our dining room that with speakers in the kitchen, and we listen to records every morning while we're getting ready for school. And we listen to records while I'm cooking dinner, while we're eating dinner. And so Michael's voice has been there, you know, and it's continued to be there since he passed away. And I hadn't even seen him for a while. Like, we had connected when I was young and when I was out there in the Portland music scene. And we did shows together. And then the last time we did a show was in this, like right before, it was February of 2020. So right before everything closed down was the last time I did a show with Michael. And I think I also just have a lot of admiration for the way he continued showing up into his old age. He always did music on his own terms. And he set the example that there's no one way to do a music career. You can really, you know, keep playing at a weird bar out in Astoria to, you know, 20 people. Like, it doesn't matter. It's about the music. And I think that the spirit of that is something that is very dear to me.
Yeah. Also, that totally lines up with the antidote to like a record label dropping you at 29 because you're too old.
Right. To be too old at 29. Come on.
Yeah. Michael's touring in Brooklyn and he's in his 80s.
So it is possible.
these connections that you've been reigniting and these new friends that you are making, like, how has it felt to make those connections and make music like this again while still, like, holding on to your identity as a parent? Like, how are you holding both of these identities?
It's a delicate dance, and it's not easy. But I think because my children are a bit older now, and they have their own lives, they have very rich lives, they have a lot of activities, and going to shows again, you know, concerts, I can leave the house at 8 o'clock, which is essentially when they're going to bed. And
they can call you on their landline.
They can call me on the landline if they need me, you know? And I think it's a lot easier for my partner to be left with both children as well. And I think we've both been giving each other the grace of, like, hey, yeah, you should go out, or he goes out, or, you know, we're doing that juggle. And for me, just like playing music with people again has felt really soul nourishing, and going and experiencing live music. I mean, there's some great music happening right now. And I think I had felt pretty uninspired by live music for a while, maybe because I wasn't participating, but I think maybe I was just too tired to even like discover anything new.
That's real.
Yeah. There's a lot of really incredible new music right now. And that is very cool. And so I've been listening to way more music of contemporaries than I had either. So that's been interesting also.
Who's ringing your bell right now?
Gosh. Well, Will Oldham just sent me his new one, which is beautiful. And we loved The Purple Bird, the one that he made in Nashville.
Yeah.
That record's great.
Wow. Yes.
I just listened to Kevin Morby's new album that was released today. I was listening to that on the drive to school. Sounds great so far. Anna Tivell's new record that came out last year. So good. Lou Hazel. I discovered Shannon Lay, who's going to do some shows with me.
Oh, yeah.
Her records are beautiful. And I'm so excited that she's going to be opening up some of my shows. Like, I think that will be a really great pairing. I don't know. There's so many.
That's
a,
listen,
a lot of people.
That's a decent list, because normally when you're like, what are you listening to? People are like, I don't know.
I don't know.
So yeah. Impressive.
Courtney Marie Andrews' new record. Super great, you know? So many.
As far as I can tell, Alila, you are basically obsessed with time.
I am.
It's passage and also, like, the present moment.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not so sure I feel about the future, but, you know,
right.
Let's focus on these two. How have you reckoned with being present while being keenly aware of time passing?
I mean, the challenge is always to be in this present moment, because it's truly all that we really have. Yet in this world where everything is just coming at you and it's chaotic and we have this too many screens open and it's really distracting to be alive right now. Yet the desire to just lay on the grass and stare at a tree is very much there. I think it's something that most humans struggle with, is how do we just exist in this present moment while knowing that we're constantly moving into the future and leaving these versions of ourselves behind. And while, you know, the seasons change and the flock of geese comes back again and another year is gone, and you know, then the flowers are blooming again and the summer heat comes, and just the cycles and the movement. And I think because I have been in this season of life that has mostly been at home, raising kids in my house, those cycles and those seasons and those circles have been very present for me. Mm-hmm. And I think also mortality, Michael's passing, my grandfather was passing away, had cancer and was dying this past year. And he died this March, about like March 17th, just a little bit shy of a year since Michael passed. And those elders, you know, making their way towards the unknown also has felt pretty real and potent for me also as I get older.
I would love to ask you several questions about death, but first I want to know, what is the deal with the geese?
The geese are just really around for me. They are at the playground at my kid's school. I see them all the time, like huge flocks. And then they come, we live right by a college in Portland called Reed College. There's a huge field. Again, the geese, they're just there. They're up in the sky. They're flying by. So they made their way into the songs. And they, to me, are symbolic of the passage of time as well. I think of, you know, the Sandy Denny song, Who Knows Where the Time Goes, where the birds always know when to return. Who's keeping time? Well, the birds certainly are, you know, the geese are. They know. They just know inside of them when to come back.
I also like want to know, all right, I was like, I don't really like asking questions about visuals on the podcast, but I feel like you have such cool visuals. Like, there are some humongous geese on your new album cover, and you're sitting like right next to them. And I was like, there is no way that this actually happened in real life.
So those are goose decoys that I ordered on the internet.
They're not real geese.
They're not real geese.
They look so real.
And they look really real. They look so real. And so I was on a walk and I was going to use a childhood photograph for the cover of the album, and it just wasn't feeling right. Nobody on the team thought it was the album cover. And I was like, trying to avoid doing a photo shoot and spending money. And, you know, I was trying to get out of that. And then I was like, okay, you can't get out of it.
Yeah.
You have to figure out what you want on this album cover. I was on a walk. I saw the flock of geese by my house, and I was like, yeah, it's the geese. How do I photograph a goose? And then I was thinking about, oh, I bet they make goose decoys for hunters. I was like, I wonder if I could track some of those down. And I think that was also right when everyone was posting photos with AI of like, what is real? What is not real? And it was a play on that as well, of this time that we're in where we don't know what's real. And just because there's a photograph of something, it doesn't mean that it actually happened, and it doesn't mean that it's real. And so for me, using the fake geese, posing as real geese in a very improbable setting, basically having a tea party with me, right?
Yeah.
In a field. Didn't happen, couldn't have happened. How did that happen? So it kind of, for me, took it into that place of playing with reality and playing with us not knowing what to believe anymore. And I think that that theme also is present on the album to some extent, of just this acknowledgement of the strange landscape we're in right now.
Wow.
That's how my brain works.
Wow. Okay. Follow-up question. Where are the decoy geese now?
They live in my house with me.
What are their names?
The children actually did name them, but they have pieces of tape on their feet so that the girls know who's who. I think one of them's name is Lucy. One is Frank. And I can't remember the other two goose's names.
We're going to need to do a follow-up interview.
Follow-up about the geese. There's one on the porch. There's a couple in the dining room. And I think one might be in a weird nook at the top of the stairs. They move around, and they're surprising to people who come over to the house.
That's so funny. Has your marketing team thought of doing special giveaway of one of the geese? I don't know if your girls could part with them, but give it away.
I like this idea.
With your record, a social media giveaway.
I'm essentially the marketing team, so I think I might have to take that up with myself.
Consult with yourself.
I could consult. I mean, I'm the one who, the whole goose thing was all me. That wow. was 100%
brilliant.
Me.
A brilliant marketing mind.
Yeah, that was just me. And everything that I've been doing on the internet right now is just me being weird in my house and trying to embrace the absurdity of where we're at right now and what's expected of artists, you know, with social media stuff. And I've mostly just been trying to enjoy it rather than resent it. And how can I be creative with this? How can I make this fun for myself? So that has been my goal. And I think I've been successful at that. At least making myself laugh, right?
Yeah. No,
I'm totally in on the joke, okay? Yeah.
Well, thank you for explaining the album cover. That went a whole lot deeper than I expected it to.
There was a lot there.
Yeah. So one more about visuals. Your daughters helped you make a music video for Dusty Roses, and it stars the three of you wearing your vintage clothes all around your house and in your yard. It's really good.
Thank you.
You all did a really good job. You and the 12-year-olds and the 9-year-olds did a really good job.
You know.
What is it like for you to be able to share and inspire creativity in a project like this? And how do you see that impacting them?
I think it's been really good for the girls to see their mom kind of get back to it, you know? And I think sometimes it's hard where they're like, ah, mom, pay attention to me, not your song or whatever. But they really enjoyed making the music video with me, which was sweet. And we brought in one of my older daughter's friends to like help use the camera. The cinematographer. And I think that made it more palatable for Vera, because otherwise I think if it had just been the three of us and then if we had not had another child helping us, Vera probably would have been like, all right, mom, I'm over it. You know, but her friend was really excited about that we were doing this, that we were making something. And so that made it more tolerable for Vera. And also Dusty Roses is both of the girls' favorite songs, which is funny. That's the one. It's a very dark story, but they're like, mom, Dusty Roses is the best.
That's the banger.
You
that's
know,
it. We're gonna
that's
TikTok,
their song.
That's the TikTok hit.
Exactly. We hope.
Okay, now to the death portion of the interview. The song Spring is a Fine Time to Die was just like, for me, like a showstopper. So Michael Hurley died April 1st, and this song is to honor him. Mm-hmm. And there is such an incredible backstory of this song. Florist friend shared with you that spring really is the kindest time to die. It's like a better time to grieve when rebirth is all around. And your grandfather that you mentioned just passed away in early spring, almost 3 days from
three days
spring.
Shy of spring, yeah.
Now that you've lost two loved ones in spring, how do you feel about it as being a good time to die?
Well, I think, you know, you're going to die in some season, right? So why not die when the flowers are blooming at the very least? And I do think, you know, grieving during that time, like when my grandfather passed this last spring and we were at his funeral down in Southern California in Carpinteria, and the bouquets on his casket were astounding, and we were all there and the sun was shining and we had an incredible gathering to honor him. And it was so potent and it was so beautiful. And it was his time. He was 90 years old. It was his time to go. And he passed in the sunlight of his window where he would sit in his chair, and they brought in a hospital bed and put it in his spot. And he had a good passing, surrounded by all his daughters in the springtime. And so I think, who knows? Is there ever a good time to go? I don't know.
Yeah.
But it's inevitable for everyone who walks this earth. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I do think it's probably better to have someone pass and then be greeted by beauty and sunlight and spring showers than it is to be in the dead of dismal winter, right? Mm.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I mean, it's so true. I feel like I thought about this and I'm like, it probably should be like right as the fall is just
fall
getting
a is so beautiful too.
Just, yeah. And but I feel like that's like a really selfish thought to have, because it's like, well, I don't want to die when it's like nice out, you know?
Right.
I'll miss it.
Oh yeah, you'll miss it.
Yeah.
Who knows?
We had I don't know if you're familiar with the artist Jeffrey Foucault, but he lost his best friend and his drummer, mm-hmm. Billy Conway. And his last record was a lot about their friendship. And Billy had what seemed like a beautiful death. And it sounds similar to your mm-hmm. grandfather's death in that he was at home. He was like surrounded. It was just basically like a 3-day party of just like 40 of his closest friends and family,
people.
Just like hanging out, making food, drinking beer, making a fire, playing music, you know, talking, laughing.
Yeah.
And it's, you don't really, you know, and I feel like that was the first time I thought about like, you know, it's really nice to have a beautiful death.
I think so. I mean, it's probably not easy whichever way you cut it. And I think even if it is a good, quote unquote, good death, or you're surrounded by all your people, it's still really hard. It's a hard task. And yeah, I don't think it's ever easy to go.
No. I've also been thinking about this as like becoming a parent with with our baby. Like,
really brings it to the surface, doesn't it?
How did that change for you? Like, when you became a parent, how did that change for you?
Well, all of a sudden, it's not just you that you're considering. It's you. You've brought this precious being, you know, into the world, and you want to protect them and save them from pain. You want to save yourself from the pain of losing them. So there's this like anxiety and this edge that kind of comes around being the provider for and the caretaker and the parent of this little being who can't take care of themselves. The responsibility of that is just enormous and fragile and yeah, just so delicate. And yeah, it's wild. I do think that birth and death are intrinsically linked, you know, that the feeling of that child coming into the world and seeing them open their eyes, and they're this little being from some place you don't understand. And I feel like that magic of the other side is still so very alive in newborns and babies.
Hmm.
Yeah, that is wild. And in my case, like when my second daughter Una was born, I almost didn't make it. And I had a really harrowing childbirth experience.
Wow.
And that also taught me how fragile life is. And I think after that experience, my perspective changed a lot, and nothing is taken for granted anymore. Yeah, when you're just like, oh, the edge isn't that far away, actually, you know?
Yeah, wow.
It's right there.
Wow, I'm sorry that happened to you.
Thank you. Yeah, these lessons and these things we learn along the way, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I wanted to ask you about your current mental state and what that looks like as you are about to hit the road for like mm-hmm. 3,000 dates the rest of the year.
I'm doing pretty well. I mean, I think the packing up, I fly out to Paris on Sunday, the packing up and the leaving and the explaining to the children that I'll be gone for 2 weeks this time. I've got more than 50 shows on the calendar for the end of the year. So
it's
I will
a long list of shows. Yeah.
A lot. I'll be gone more than I've been since I've had the girls. And I've gone for like 3 weeks at a time several times over the course of a year before, but never like this. And thankfully, my husband is very capable of holding it down. And I know that when I leave, they have their routine. And we also have grandmas who can come help here and there.
Grandmas.
Thanks, grandmas. So helpful. And I think I'm mostly just nervous about, like, okay, is my voice going to be able to take, you know, to do this? And my body, because it's really a physical grind to be on tour. And I just hope that I can remain healthy. I think that's a worry, because it does take a physical toll carrying that much heavy stuff every day and being in a different city every night. And I think there will be a certain amount of whiplash that I experience sort of being gone, being on the road, living that life, and then coming home and not really getting to rest and decompress from tour, but rather immediately being jolted into being needed by my family and having the being in the role of mother all of a sudden. So yeah, I think in some ways, now that I am a parent, sometimes tour feels, I mean, it's a break from parenthood. And so I'm like, how can I make a 6-hour ride in a van feel like nourishing self-care? How is a long haul flight, you know, a time to decompress?
Right.
So right. We'll see how that goes.
Yeah. Well, it's a good thing you're feeling so youthful.
Right.
Yeah. Well, let's wrap up with a quick lightning round.
All right.
All right. You're going to be great at this.
Thanks.
What is the correct number of shoes to bring on tour?
The correct answer is 2.
Okay.
1 to wear during the day when you're traveling, and 1 to wear on stage. Sometimes I break that rule and bring maybe 3 pairs, but my friend Paige from the band Two Runner, I took them on tour last November, and I think she had like literally 10 pairs of boots with her, and I was giving her hell the whole time.
That's a lot.
It was a lot of boots. They were way too heavy. But I do think 2 is the correct answer.
Okay. I'm interested in what kind of shoes you are wearing during the day.
So generally, I really have this down to a science. Usually I have the road uniform, generally all black, keep it simple, or jeans and black, because you're wearing the same thing every day. You got to wear a t-shirt like 3 days in a row because you can't do laundry. And Blundstones. I mean, if it's a winter tour or spring tour, this time that might not be the case because I think it'll be warmer. So I'll probably make a different choice. But generally, it's Blundstones and jeans and all blacks, accessory like bandanas, things like that to make you feel a little spruced up are helpful. And then fancy lace-up boots for show and dresses.
Gosh, I feel like you should give like a course on how
to
pack for tour, because this is really good.
I do have it down to a science, and I'm really good at packing for tour.
Okay.
Not to toot my own horn, but
I'm going to refer all of my touring musician friends who have questions to you.
Yes.
Okay, this is an important one. What year do you predict aliens will take over Earth's government?
Ooh. Oh, God. It's probably sooner than we think, isn't it?
Who's to say it hasn't happened already?
Good point. I give it 100 years.
100 years. All right. Okay.
Yeah.
What's one beauty product you cannot live without?
Chapstick.
All right. Who is your celebrity crush?
Oh, God. Celebrity crush.
Is it Tom Brousseau?
It's not Tom Brousseau, but I love Tom Brousseau. No, it's probably someone who's no longer alive. It's Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid.
Oh, all right.
It's epic. Both of them.
Epic.
Yeah, it's Robert Redford, 100%. Robert,
okay. That's a good one. And that tracks.
Yeah.
His color scheme matches yours.
It's good.
What's one song you wish you wrote?
Comes a Time by Neil Young.
Ooh, okay.
It's a good song. Love that song.
This one you will like. What is your favorite season?
Fall or spring.
Okay, interesting. Also, you'll like this one. What do you want done with your body when you die?
Definitely cremated.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And then this is the last one. Very important. What is your coffee order?
My coffee order is an English breakfast tea with oat milk and honey.
Wow. A rebel.
Yeah.
A true rebel.
I do sometimes drink a Dixie cup of coffee in the morning, though, when my husband makes it. I have this little tiny ceramic cup that's like the size of a Dixie cup. And that's so all I'm allowed
like
to have.
Like an espresso cup size?
Yeah, like that size. Just like a taste. But precious. I get too jittery if I do too much coffee. So I'm kind of just, I kind of just can't go there unless it's a Dixie cup, you know?
Great. Well, that was it. That was a lightning round.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. I had a great time talking to you.
As
I remember,
did
I knew I liked you.
Yes. Love it.
This episode of Basic Folk was produced by Anthony Cabrera. Dietrich Strauss composes our music. Basic Folk is a production of The Bluegrass Situation. You can find all of our episodes there. You can also find us on FolkAlley.com or Folk Alley's mobile app. Search for Basic Folk on the SiriusXM app. You can go to BasicFolk.com or find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you enjoyed this episode, we suggest sharing it with a friend. Like maybe that friend who owns a very humongous old Victorian house and walks the widow's walk back and forth, and they need something to listen to while they're walking the widow's walk. Send them this episode. All right, thanks for listening all the way to the end. Talk to you next time. Bye.